is the Licensing and Procurement Librarian at the National Agricultural Library, and Hope O'Keefe is a Senior Associate General Counsel for the Library of Congress. So they will have a lot of really good information for us today. The way the workshop will go, we're going to spend about 30 minutes or so with Vicki and Hope giving us kind of a copyright 101 session, giving us some overviews of things that, they work on, especially copyright law, publishing in the electronic age, and also fair use. And those will be things that we'll be talking about throughout the session. After that introductory period, we're going to look at some, we're going to spend about 45 minutes or so looking at some common scenarios that might be very similar to things that you have experienced in your own work. And so we'll do some overviews of those. We definitely encourage discussion in this section. So we'd like to hear of some of the issues that you've dealt with and how you have dealt with those. And then our panelists will also be guiding us through those scenarios as well. And then whatever remaining time we have at the end, we are going to play a little round of Stump the Panelists. So any questions that you might have on copyright issues, fair use and publishing or instruction or anything related to your research, feel free to ask those. We'll have time to dig into some of these topics, and I think it'll really help guide us in understanding copyrights and how to really apply best practices to our work. So without further ado, I would like to introduce Hope O'Keefe, who will start us out on some Copyright 101.
That involves getting stuff in. And for the more interesting part of it is getting it out, making it accessible. And that involves a lot of time working with copyright, working with permissions, working with fair use, and frankly, working with some risk assessment. And so I'm going to touch a little bit on all of those. I think in a small group that if you want to just raise your hand, and be a little bit more flexible and have a little bit less of the talking heads. I guess one question I have, a little sense of how many of you are classroom educators? Extension folks? Any other big categories I've missed? And it will depend. A little bit in the way that you use things and the way that your institution is going to analyze the risk of reusing things. Basic first question, what is copyrightable? And this is language from the statute. It's got to be an original work of authorship. It's got to be fixed. That means it doesn't necessarily mean written down, but it can be digitally fixed. What isn't covered is grand gestures. Something, since this is like I'm not being videotaped, then that is not fixed. And it has to be able to be perceived either by a human being or by a machine. So that's a pretty broad description. What isn't copyrightable? Ideas by themselves are not going to be copyrightable. What's copyrightable is the expression of those ideas, the way that they're described when they are fixed. And something of great annoyance to scientists is that something else that isn't copyrightable is facts. And that means that a lot of data is not going to be copyrightable. It may be protected by other forms of intellectual property that we're going to pretend don't exist for the moment, because that may be protected, for example, by patents. It may be protected by trademarks in some instances. And something that Vicki's going to talk about later, a lot of times it may be protected by licenses. So the data that you acquire pursuant to license, it may not be copyrightable, but you still can't do whatever you please with it. So next slide. So in order to be copyrightable, it does not have to be registered at all. That law changed in 1976. All it has to be copyrightable, copyright applies automatically. If copyright attaches at the moment that it is fixed, at the moment that it's written down. And it doesn't have to be published either. So it doesn't have to be published, it doesn't have to be registered. Obviously, publication gives you a lot of protection, more protection because it's easier to prove that it's yours. And registration, if you're in the unfortunate position of having to sue to protect your copyright, then it's very helpful to have registered it. One of the myths that United States Copyright Office is in the Library of Congress. So I have to do a little shirling for them. If you register your work, then you can sue to protect it if you have to. And that is a very, very important protection. It's also an important international protection. So what do you get once you fix something? What are your exclusive rights? Copyright is a form of property. It's intellectual property. So it's something that you own, and that only the copyright owner. And the copyright owner is not, as any of you who have published know, you're not necessarily the copyright owner just because you created something. You can sign it all over to your university if it ends up in your work for hire or your extension service, and you can certainly sign it over to a publisher. But once you own that copyright, then you have the exclusive right to make copies of it, to reproduce it. You have the exclusive right to what are called derivative works, to in the non-horticultural science example of that is you take a novel, you turn it into a screenplay. The screenplay is a derivative work. Or if you take a written data set and you turn it into, and it's a copyrightable data set, you turn it into an article, you turn your article into a book, each of those, well, the book is maybe a derivative work of the article. A compilated, the published article is going to be a derivative work of your manuscript. You have the right to distribute those copies that you have made so that once you make the copies, you are the only one who can send them out or give others permission to send them out. Public performance may or not apply to what you do, but frankly, if you're getting up and you're putting your work to song or creating or doing a presentation like this, It is your exclusive right to perform your work. And finally, if your sound recordings, if somehow you created an audiobook of your article, then there are exclusive rights that apply to your sound recordings as well. And when you talk about exclusive rights, that's something that you can convey, meaning that you can share it with someone, you can give someone else the right to do any of these things. Or you can say, I want to work on this more. It's not ready to be published. And you can then keep anyone else from publishing on your behalf. So the basic rules of how you use a copyrighted work. I think most of you, it sounds like most of you in the room are both copyright makers and copyright users. So the way that you use it, again, it is a property interest. It can be transferred like any other kind of property. Typically, it's going to be transferred in writing. But you don't, just because I own this piece of paper doesn't mean I have copyright in it. In fact, this particular piece of paper, I have no copyright in it because I'm a government, I'm a government employee. You own this. It's a U.S. government work. It's not subject to copyright. I have no rights in it. There are limitations and exceptions that apply to copyright. does the unity know about the various exceptions that teachers are allowed? There are some special rules that apply to libraries and to archives that allow us to distribute things, to make copies of things, make copies of research, for example, in special ways. And there's a doctrine called fair use that, unfortunately, Crystal is not here to talk about. So I'll be talking about that after Vicki finishes. The main thing that is very important for you to take away from this is that just because in this digital world it's easy to copyright, to copy something and to distribute it, doesn't mean that it's legal, doesn't mean that you should. And that's very, very true, particularly in digital works. And another factor to take into account, we were talking about this a little bit at lunch, so just because you can doesn't mean you should. And the other side of that is just because something is legal to copy doesn't mean it's necessarily the right thing to do. And we'll talk about that a little bit as we get into the case studies. I've created a decision tree. It's probably the most useful thing that you'll walk out of here. So you start out with the issue of whether or not what rights you already have in the copyright. Is it something that you created? Is it something appropriately licensed? Is it something that you have permission to use? So go ahead and use it. Second question is whether or not it's protected by copyright at all. Is it something, for example, that was published in the United States more than 95 years ago, so pre-1923? If it's not subject to copyright, then you can again go ahead and use it. Very complicated rules on duration, which you can look up if you need to. Try and keep this short. Right now, everything is copyrighted for the life of the author plus 70 years in the United States, and that's close to a standard in most of the world now. If something is protected by copyright, then you look at those limitations and exceptions, is there fair use? And if not, then you look at whether or not you can get permission. And if you can't get permission, you look at whether or not you can use something else. There's a lot of stuff now being published either through open access, with permission, with broad rights, such as Creative Commons licenses. You can always find something like that. Or you can find something that's in the public domain. And finally, you look at whether or not your level of risk is acceptable when using something. And that's the very high level how copyright works. And we can either, does anyone have any questions at this point? Yes. One advantage of registration, if you do sue, is we have something called statutory damages. You don't have to prove what your damages are, and those add up pretty fast. It's a minimum of $35,000 for each act of violation. of a copyright violation. So that is a major advantage of registration if you are trying to, if you have work of sufficient time on shared value that you want to protect it. On the flip side of it is that you don't have to. There's a whole growing ecosystem out there right now of open science, open data. You can protect it through mechanisms like broad Creative Commons licensing, where you simply attach your which is legally enforceable, but where you're attaching, for example, CC BY, you just require attribution, or you limit it to non-commercial uses. And there are multiple ways that you can protect your work short of registration by using licensing.
Another question?
I just want to make sure I'm clear. So you're telling me, since the copyright law changed, that anything you write down is copyright? Or it's copyright.
Already copyright. It's hard to enforce the copyright. You will have people telling you that if you mail something to yourself, you'll be able to prove that it's copyrightable. That's called a poor man's copyright. That's enough. You can prove that you have a postmark envelope so that you show when you write it. That's completely unenforceable.
All right. What about electronic media, like a PowerPoint presentation, for example?
Absolutely.
All right. So another question is to follow up on that is someone wants to borrow a piece of your presentation. What do you do? Do you respond that, well, that's copyrighted? What do you do?
That's right.
The answer is it is up to you. If you are allowed to, the answer is you can ask that decision just because it's not available doesn't mean you can't get permission to use it. You can say yes, you can say no. Well, I guess we might get into it, but is permission verbal permission or is that written permission? It does. Technically,
And when we do cover this case study, I have a feeling that's a question that a lot of people in here have. And I know it's a question that comes up in my work all the time. So I'm hoping that we can definitely spend some more time on that a little bit later. Maybe we'll hear from Vicki now about publishing in the electronic age.
The materials of the National Agricultural Library. We are a national library and we're open to the public as well, but we also serve as the corporate library for USDA and all the researchers there. So we definitely need to make sure information they want to be free, but it's not. We have to honor and respect everybody's copyright and also ensure that our researchers are retaining the rights that they're entitled to. Yes, they're government workers, but there are still considerations of what they can or cannot do with information that they acquired in their research and information that they produce. So my role here is to offer suggestions for good resources you can turn to based on some of the experiences I've had and been taught about. It's not legal advice. I'll say it again, I'm not a lawyer, this is not legal advice. These are some tips and things to consider. And I will provide a whole bunch of links to some resources that I find really useful. And again, they may change over time, so I didn't quote a whole lot from those sources. Each situation that comes up, you're going to need to do a little bit of thinking and a little bit of digging around, because this stuff is evolving. Just going from print to the electronic age, going from U.S. copyright to now it's global. Once it hits the internet, or if you're using a foreign publisher, all the laws aren't the same. So you need to consider those sorts of things. So in my role at USDA, I am maintaining enterprise license agreements with dozens of publishers. An enterprise license means that the entire population of your defined entity, in this case your FDA, employees, the contractors, people who walk in to use the library, have certain rights that I have licensed from the copyright holder. And so the first thing I've got to figure out is who actually owns the copyright. Our USDA researchers may or may not have any copyrightable interest because we are government. However, they can sign away the government's rights to some publisher if they're not careful. So those are things I need to look for, because obviously we want our own research available, but if it's now owned by another publisher, then I have to license the rights back in order to use it. So when you're out there doing research, think about where your money's coming from. If it's coming from any federal sources, that can have some implications there. Who do you want to be able to use it? And along with the can you do it, should you do it, it's the yes, it may be a noble and good thing to do, but if you're violating somebody's copyright in doing it, it doesn't matter how noble your cause is. So you really need to think about can you, should you, legally, ethically, and what does your boss say? What does your legal counsel say? Because that gets back to risk assessment. You can do the handshake. Yeah, sure, use my PowerPoint. That's a certain level of risk. Now, so you have to decide, is it worth it? Again, if somebody says, sure, use my slides, if you don't get it in writing, if you were told you could use those slides, you know, how much is it worth? How much is the risk worth? The other thing, when you're looking at what do you want to do, from the library perspective, I license for all USDA employees and only USDA employees, and then I'm responsible for trying to figure out how to control that when we've got the general public wandering through. We also have some site licenses, which means that, well, and that depends, again, on your definition of site license in your agreement. Does that mean just the physical building you're in? Does that mean the campus that you're building is on? You know, is it a geographic site or is it a physical building? And the library looks for different aspects of an agreement that may or may not apply to an individual, such as that the course packs for academic use, the right to interlibrary loan, especially for electronic. It used to be, okay, we buy a tangible book and we could loan it out to you and you give it back and we loan it to somebody else. Well, now if we have the digital copy of an article, thousands of people could borrow it and never pay for it. So again, that goes into some of the what rights do we have for redistribution, what has the copyright owner given us, and then what can you do with it if you come to us as a library. Post-cancellation access is a real biggie now that everything's electronic. You can subscribe, and then as soon as you stop paying your subscription fee, your right to access that goes away. I try to license it so that, okay, if I bought the 2018 all editions of the journal, if I don't renew it in 2019, I can still access the electronic version of 2018. It's a whole different world when it's electronic, and with the push of a button, somebody can turn off your access or delete the whole file. So when I'm looking at what are my rights, what do I want to license, or what do the publishers or the copyright owner actually have, there are a couple of good glossaries that I have put up here to try and translate some of this stuff. Because for each license from each publisher, they might have a little bit different definition. And you want to make sure you understand what you're agreeing to or what you're signing away on. Even just to have a good conversation with your legal counsel or your copyright specialist in your organization, it helps to have the cheat sheet of the glossary to know exactly what they're talking about. Again, there's just an example here of the LIB license is a discussion group that I participate in. They have a vocabulary. They also have some sample licenses and some things to look for or watch out for. Again, the URL is there. You can browse through that. And I would recommend that whenever you come into one of your personal situations, look through some of these resources just to see if it triggers anything in your mind, a question you might want to ask or something you haven't thought about. And those sites will change as laws change, as precedents are set.
People get burned on things. When it comes to scientific research, especially if it is done by or funded by taxpayer money or a government institution, we're trying to capture that and make sure that the taxpayer gets as much access as possible. And there is a little bit of give and take because a lot of the publishing has been done by commercial entities. And we need to respect that and understand that, you know, their distribution channel was aggressively in the past or, you know, electronically. We depend on that to get this information out. But there's a cost involved, and we don't want to run them out of business just because, you know, we think our information should be free. So we are participating in science.co, which is where you can find an awful lot of U.S. government science information. Not all, but we're trying. It's free access to R&D results across 13 federal agencies. It is, you know, an online resource, so definitely stop there and see how that fits in with what are they doing. I mean, you know, is there advice or warnings there or examples you might want to follow? I'm not going to read the whole slide to you, but you see all the different agencies that are involved in science.gov. WorldwideScience.org is beyond federal, it's global. The Office of Scientific and Technical Information in the Department of Energy has pulled that together. Again, trying to make information as available as possible worldwide, given that, you know, we have language and legal and geographic issues. We want scientific information to be as readily accessible as possible. So again, using those sites, you can find out what's already out there and easily usable versus, you know, what things may or may not be. I've posted here the basic text from the 2013 OSTP memorandum that basically said, hey, the taxpayers are paying for this research. It has to be made available. Free public access, to the extent feasible and permitted by law, which is where it comes back around to, we've got to be careful not to put the baby out with the bathwater, to give away rights that we already had because it was government funded. Counterbalancing that again with, we work hand in hand with publishers to make sure that it's formatted in the right way and distributed in the right way. So those are things to consider, both as a user of something that might be copyrighted, but also if you are generating something that could be copyrighted, pay attention to how do you want this to be able to be used, or how does your agency employer expect it to be used, and make sure you're not closing any doors that you want to leave open. A resource that we find really helpful in the library, it's hard to keep track of who owns copyright. There is an agency, the Copyright Clearance Center. It's voluntary, but when we are copying in the library and it's not very, you know, clearly obvious that we're paying, hitting a paywall and paying for the article outright and what we can do with it, we can go to the Copyright Clearance Center and find out and pay through their service a fee, which gives us the right to whatever it's specified that we're doing with it. In our case, it's usually providing a copy to somebody else.
And if I can interrupt, your university almost definitely works with the copy.
And so that's a relatively quick and easy way to keep honest. Creative Commons, we mentioned that earlier too. A nonprofit organization came up with this idea, and it's trying to simplify keeping some reasonable rights for the creator or the owner, I guess, of intellectual property without getting bogged down in legalese. Whitehouse.gov actually uses a Creative Commons license on their website if you want to see how that works. And it basically comes down to, depending on the level of Creative Commons license you want to use, it's, you know, be fair, give us credit, you can use this stuff where you want to, just tell us from anywhere you got it from, and don't, you know, mess around with it, change it, and then claim you got it from White House or whoever. International copyright. There is no such thing. There is no one international law for copyright. It's sort of evolving, like anything else. Each country has their history and their culture and their perspective on information and commerce and rights and penalties and that sort of thing. So if you're going to copyright something, know where it's being copyrighted, know where it's being published, and know how a given country might perceive that. If you're vacationing and you write your autobiography, it might be different than if you're sitting in your office here in the good old US of A. Are you writing it on a napkin? Are you writing it digitally? Different rules apply. So you definitely want to check out where and how the laws apply in your particular situation. Just a brief mention of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Again, there's a big difference in how things were looked at when we were all print and as they sort of evolved into the digital world, electronic music, that sort of thing. And it's based partly on electronic commerce, but again, you have to consider intellectual, international aspects of intellectual property. It's not just what you think it should be or what you can use to it be in your hometown. And again, the links are there for you to review the text as it was written, but then you, again, want to keep up with how is this being applied, how is it evolving. I mean, that was brand new on a big deal in 1998, but that was a long time ago now.
Thank you, Vicki. We will be posting, just so you know, we will be posting this presentation online, so you'll have access to these links if you weren't able to get them all written down. We'll talk a few minutes quickly about fair use, get an overview of that, and then we'll go into some of these case studies where we can talk about some practical applications of these concepts. So, Hope, would you like to talk a little bit about fair use?
Probably many of our universities are going to be able to work from one organization. One of the things that they have done is a lot of work in developing best practices for fair use. And Viber is as organized as Vicki. I wouldn't give any links, but if you Google fair use best practices, you'll be able to access them. And I would particularly point to one for research libraries and going for orphan works. So fair use is the big exception. It's one of the limitations and exceptions in addition to the library rights, educator rights, to the requirement that you get permission before you use something. The statute says that it's for purposes such as, so that simply examples, it's not an exclusive list. Criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, and research, i.e. a lot of what you guys do. However, just because it's for teaching and scholarship doesn't mean it's necessarily going to be fair use, as any textbook publisher is going to tell you. If there are people that are out there making their living writing textbooks, they don't necessarily want you to be able to grab them and run them through your scanner and give them to your students. So the determination of fair use, the idea of fair use is that it's a loophole. It's an escape valve that the Supreme Court has described as rooted in the First Amendment. It's rooted in free speech. And as a result, it's a balancing test. So it's a balance of four factors. The first factor is the nature of the use. Is it non-commercial? Is it transformative? Is it something that's different from the use that something was originally created for? So that if I create a newspaper archive, news and Library of Congress has huge newspaper archives, newspapers were originally designed to give you news of the day, and tomorrow it's good for wrapping your fish and lining your bird cage. But if I take it 10 years later, it's used for a completely transformative purpose. Scanning books, the Google Books project, that's another example where the use where it was making printed books accessible to the blind. Court held that was a fair use. It's the right thing to do, making things more accessible, that were completely inaccessible, but not a transformative use. Books were written to be read, and what we're doing is making it possible for people with visual disabilities to read it. So that's not transformative, it's precisely the same use. But if you're taking it and you're allowing people to, as Google did, create a digital index so that you can look up references that aren't in the physical index, because Google is going to allow you to do a keyword search on the roughly 17 million volumes that they now have and the Hathi Press now has, then that is a transformative use. It's something that you were not able to do when it was a paper book. Courts are currently saying that's the most important of the four factors, whether or not something was transformative. The second issue, which relates quite a bit probably to the folks in this room, is the nature of the copyrighted work. Is it published or unpublished? If it's unpublished, it's a little bit less likely to be fair use. But the more important factor, the more important question of the nature of the work is this something that's highly creative or is this something that's purely factual? The further it is on that fact continuum makes it more likely that the use is going to be a fair use. Again, no one of these factors is dispositive, but these are the things that a court will look at and that you will look at in determining whether or not you have a good defense. In your work. The third factor is the amount of the work that you're using. So this is where we talk about copyrights. Oh, if I use 230 seconds of a sound recording, or if I use no more than one chapter, or no more than X number of words, then it's safe, it's going to be fair use. That's not particularly helpful, and it's not necessarily true. There are some guidelines out there, but there's also a very big lawsuit out there being brought against Georgia State by the Copyright Clearance Center, funded by the Copyright Clearance Center, and being brought by some academic publishers. Because, again, academic publishing is an industry, and they don't want their primary audience or their primary market. These universities just up and taking it. The fourth, at the same time, what courts are now saying is that you should not be using more than you need to use to accomplish your purpose. If Google is scanning all of the books so that you can index them, you have to scan the whole thing in order to accomplish that purpose. And that, as a result, in the Google Books case, it was found to be fair use. At the same time, if what you're taking is a small portion of the work, but it goes to the heart of the matter, that has been held not to be fair use. The main Supreme Court case on that involved President Ford's autobiography. And a magazine took a really short part of Ford's autobiography, his discussion of his pardon for President Nixon, which just happened to be the only reason why anybody would buy an autobiography. And the Supreme Court held it that taking that really went to the heart of it, and therefore was not fair use. And the fourth fair use factor is the effect on the market. And some cases have now been holding it. The question is also, is it licensable? Fair use is very, very issue. The fifth factor, they say, is what You don't go to the fair use until you've gone to a judge and it's been appealed, and then the Supreme Court has ruled on it or denied cert, which all of which is very expensive. So people will try to scare you away from fair use. There's always an element of risk. As Vicki mentioned, risk assessment attached when you're arguing fair use. And that's where the best practices that the Association of Research Libraries and other institutions have pulled together are very helpful. I can tell my kids, well, just because the other kids do it that way doesn't mean that it's okay. But it's pretty useful to us to say that, in fact, this is the way that it works, that it works in the real world. And that, and I have very successfully used those principles to defend uses without permission. So fair use is a very useful tool. And I want to talk a little bit about that risk assessment. It's very expensive to get permission, and sometimes it's impossible to get permission. There's an issue of orphan works, which are, an orphan work is when you may know who, may not know who wrote it or who created it, because it's a photograph without a label on it. Or you may be unable to locate it, even though you think that it's in copyright. And that's a situation where, you know, very often people are able to rely on fair use. But risk assessment. The question, there's a saying out there that everybody should violate copyright, but they should do it knowingly. That you need to be aware of what you're doing, who is going to care. You don't always know who is going to care, but to be very, very aware and create that balance for yourself of whether or not it's appropriate and within your institution's guidelines and your personal guidelines as to whether or not this is something that you can or should use without permission. And it can be a very tough call. And that's where developing best practices and working with your counselor or working with your other folks in the faculty can be very helpful.
Thank you. All right, let's open things up to a little bit of discussion. We'll take one question before we get started on some of these case studies. Sure.
Yeah.
Your comments on fair use made me go immediately to thoughts of interlibrary loans and the issues that we're experiencing as a society where one library will buy this journal, another will buy that journal, and then they can share back and forth the materials. Essentially, you're affecting the market there.
So
how do we put a stop to that?
That comes under another broken, which is another exception called Section 108, which is one that applies specifically to libraries and archives. There were guidelines that developed a very long time ago for interlibrary loan, which is specifically that interlibrary loan cannot be used as a substitute for subscription. So there are guidelines that libraries have been applying for damn close to 40 years now about the number of times you can borrow a particular book or a particular article before you're required to buy a copy. And at that point, you're not supposed to be able to borrow it anymore.
I was thinking more about the number of times that they borrow a work science article and don't have the subscription anymore.
Well, that's not just the same article, but
different articles from the same journal.
And that's why libraries are spending more and more money on subscriptions, because as the subscription base contracts, because it's easier to make copies of things than the costs are just really becoming astronomical. And you do end up looking at some of the alternatives to journals. So if you look at, I don't know what the agricultural version of PubMed is, which is what they're like, pardon? Okay. PubMed, okay. But so you start absolutely, it's a real problem, and it goes into that fourth factor. And I mentioned the Georgia State case. That is why Georgia State has been sued by the publishers, because they were putting things into their course packs beyond the what are called these Con2 guidelines. And the argument of the publishers was that it was not fair use that, and that they had to subscribe.
And that's also, too, where the copyright clearance center comes in. If we don't have a subscription to something, we track how many times we borrow from that journal. And when it hits the threshold, and I think the last time I was in the Librarian Lab, it was five articles. Yep, it was just sold out. No, then we were paying. We would go to copyright clearance, and we would register each time then that we warned that particular thing out, because we don't have any desire to run publishers out of business. The more the merrier. There are financial constraints. There are, you know, what is reasonable to me might not be reasonable to you, but there are all kinds of checks and balances. And again, it goes back to risk assessment. Do we want to balance the publisher, because it turns around that the subscription rates are going to go up? So we don't really end up gaining anything by doing that. So again, it's finding a balance and doing what is reasonable, legal, ethical, and works as a win-win for everybody as best we can.
Great, thanks. The first scenario that we have to look at is related to open access. And I think what we'll do is we have six of these to go over, and there's definitely some overlap among them, but I think we'll try to tailor these to who's here. And so if you have any specific questions about each of these, we'll definitely spend time on them. If there are some scenarios that we look at that maybe no one is really concerned with, we can pass over them. But open access has certainly become a bigger issue, and there are plenty of government grant programs that now require open access as part of the grant. And I'm wondering if anyone has any specific questions that they've come across in this kind of situation.
Some people call government published information open access. Technically, that's a stretch of that particular phrase, the way most publishers use it. Publishers who publish open access charge the author a fee rather than the library or the subscriber. Somebody is handing money over. And again, you can depend on the particular deal that was cut with that particular publication. So there is no one answer for what's the trend, who owns it. It depends. You've got to read whatever open access agreement you're trying to sign and think about your own man's goal. The Ag Library has turned down paying for open access to our publishers. We still go with the strictness. Some of the USDA researchers and USDA itself are paying open access fees, but at a library, they stuck with the subscription model because, again, open access can mean a lot of different things, and it's not something that we have the expertise to manage all the different definitions and permutations. So, again, how does it affect subsequent publication, and what does my publisher want exclusive rights? Well, depends on who had the original rights and what they signed off and what they kept. So you really need to do your research in your particular situation. There is no one answer for that one.
It's also, I think it's a growing trend in universities, and I don't know if it's true of any of your universities, in addition to the grant requirement that you deposit a copy of your research and articles resulting from grant research. Very often now the universities requiring that deposit with the university the work that you've done. But again, there are all kinds of limitations on what access is, and to some degree you assign it away when you sign for publication.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions on that particular topic? Yes.
module database, those kind of things. And it's all funded by us again. A colleague approached me to borrow the data, part of the data, for students to do practice on a certain computer software. And then they ended up wanting to publish an article. So I requested them, you have to acknowledge my name and my co-workers, my colleagues, that put the effort together to acquire this original data to start with. What's the issue here? I mean, they want to use a part of the data to do their own work. I granted their permission. I said, this is, you know, public information is fine. But they want to publish their article without including us, because they believe that's their right to use the analysis part that was not in our original research scenario. So what's your recommendation?
Now, this is a make-the-believe part. It's just make-the-believe.
I think some people run into similar issues with your colleagues or a grad student asking for a part of data to do something else.
That is literally case study number two.
I should put it up there. Yeah, there it is.
And then this goes back to the question of what is legal versus what is right. And what is the best practice, what is the best professional practice. But if you're doing that analysis, if you're the one who wants to use the data, you start by looking at what rights are attached to the data. You look at whether it's open public data, such as you just described, so that there would be fewer legal restrictions on it. You look at whether it's a government work. You also would have to look at whether this data is a licensed database, which is going to put controls on it and contractual limitations on it that are wholly separate from whatever copyright limitations might be. So you have to look at how you got this data. If you're doing a copyright analysis, you want to look at the nature of the data. Is it just pure numbers? Is it just pure biological facts versus something that's creative expression? Because as it started out, we were saying pure facts, pure data is not going to be copyrightable. Great case just came down this week. Someone complained. This is in the EU, that somebody, that another company had copied the taste of their cheese. And the ruling, even in the EU, which protects data and has stronger rights than we have here in the United States, is no, the taste of cheese is not copyrightable. Perhaps it's patentable, perhaps it's trademarkable, certainly the name of the cheese is, but it's something that is not subject to copyright. Then the next thing you want to look at is how you're using the data. Are you just using it are you republishing it? We talked, I think before, about taking the same table and just republishing precisely the same table unchanged without a different analysis. That's going to be more problematic than if, as in your maybe hypothetical, if you're taking the same data, interpreting it, analyzing it in a different way. That is more likely to be something that looks like a fair use. You want to look at whether or not your use of it is transformational. Are you using precisely the same data trying to reproduce the same results? Or are you just plagiarizing? There's a difference between copyright and plagiarism. Something may not be a violation of copyright, but may still be a violation of academic proprieties. And then you start looking what the best practices in the field. I would assume that the best practice is always going to be basic courtesy and attribution. That's not a legal requirement. It's just the right thing to do. Can you sue them for not giving you attribution? Perhaps not, unless you've attached a Creative Commons license to something. Can you trash them to everyone you know? Yeah. Can you say, I'm being semi-serious here. Reputation is so important. Collaboration is so important. And what these students are going to learn is that if they don't treat me with courtesy, they may not be treated with courtesy down the line. But it's very much, it's a way that we all want to be teaching our students a sense of professional ethics.
In a case like this, they're going to have to put a method section where the database was generated as a reviewer of an article. If they didn't tell me how the original data was generated, it'd be rejected. So I don't think I have an option.
That's the
good point.
And in terms of that, if you are getting permission, this is an instance where you don't need permission by your hypothetical that didn't need permission, although only they got permission but aren't providing the attribution, it was a condition for permission. We don't know who, and that's what Vicky described as figuring out who has the copyright can be very difficult. It may be the researchers, it might be the university, it may be the publisher, and it's all annoyingly craft specific. Any other questions about this hypothetical?
We've been talking about data a little bit. I wonder if you would mind if we jumped around a little. And I know there are some questions on things like reusing PowerPoint slides. And so